Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia on the 14th of February 2015. My name's Herriwood Fenton. Welcome to the show. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours and we'll be covering a range of topics, as always, with the focus being on what's not being properly covered, what's not properly understood, and what is really, really important for the future of humanity. In the first hour, I'm going to be focusing a little on the economy. And I'm going to talk about some things which are not widely discussed, but which seem to be extremely ominous and extremely important. We'll be talking about the rocketing US dollar, and we'll be talking about the deflationary spiral which seems to be taking over in Europe, and what that all means. I have a very strong feeling that this is going to be the year, again, where something catastrophic happens with the global economy. But we'll be getting into that shortly. Now, I just want to run through some of the other things we're going to be talking about in today's show. I want to play to you a press conference from the WikiLeaks team, including their top legal advisors, that document some recent developments in the Julian Assange case and the overarching progress with the US appearing to be pursuing WikiLeaks on espionage charges and some of the quite extreme measures that have been taken, actions taken against WikiLeaks journalists, which are really quite shocking. And that'll be going to play to you some long excerpts from that press conference, because I think it's very important to be aware of it. Now, in the second hour, I'm welcoming back to the show Stephanie Messenger, who is a vaccine campaigner, a pro-choice vaccine campaigner who's been on this show several years ago. Stephanie popped up again in the news recently around Australia because she was the person responsible for trying to bring vaccine information campaigner Dr. Cherie Tenpenny to Australia. And, of course, we've been documenting that on the show over the past few weeks. Stephanie was the person behind that. And in the second hour of today's show, I will be going through in detail with her what happened and why Dr. Tenpenny's speaking tour was cancelled. And you will be quite amazed, folks, at what the information she has to tell us. I mean, what we're facing here in the case of the suppression of this information is pure fascism. It is terrorism. It is fascism. And it's happening completely under our noses and in the guise of a democratic society. And, of course, the mainstream media, as you may imagine, has completely failed to even document that these things happened, that people were threatened, that bomb threats were called in, that threats of physical violence were made against people for simply providing a venue where Cherie Tenpenny could speak. But instead, the media hyped up all kinds of claims against Dr. Tenpenny and gave platforms for people to actually accuse Dr. Tenpenny and people like her of effectively being like terrorists. And the AMA and various other representations of medical authorities have had a platform to basically strut around and claim the moral high ground, when in fact what happened was terrorism against these people who simply wanted to provide information. I mean, things have never been more morally inversed than they are today, folks. I mean, when you combine this with looking at what's happened with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and various other things going on around the world, for example, the ISIS situation and the way that the way that's been misrepresented and the way in which, you know, free speech is championed while at the same time it's being suppressed, but it's only championed when people want to attack Islam. The inversion of morality and the truly almost satanic reversal of truth is something that we really need to ponder on and sort of meditate on to try and understand how things got so bad and how what seems to be pure evil has kind of just taken off. You know, it's like an epidemic of psychopathic evil, which is sort of run rampant through a particular strata of our society, and you know, mainly through those channels of the media and government. So that's all coming up. Let's turn now to have a look at the economic situation. And I want to start with an article from the Economic Collapse blog, a site that's featured regularly on Infowars.com. And the title of the article is "Guess What Happened the Last Time the US Dollar Skyrocketed in Value Like This?" Over the past decade, there has been only one other time when the value of the US dollar has increased by so much in such a short period of time. That was in mid-2008, just before the greatest financial crash since the Great Depression. A surging US dollar also greatly contributed to the Latin American debt crisis of the early 1980s and the Asian financial crisis of 1997. Today, the globe is much more interconnected than ever. Most global trade is conducted in US dollars, and much of the borrowing done by emerging markets all over the planet is denominated in US dollars. When the US dollar goes up dramatically, this can put a tremendous amount of financial stress on economies all around the world. It also has the potential to greatly threaten the stability of the $65 trillion in derivatives that are directly tied to the value of the US dollar. The global financial system is more vulnerable to currency movements than ever before. And history tells us that when the US dollar soars, the global economy tends to experience a contraction. So the fact that the US dollar has been skyrocketing lately is a very, very bad sign. Most of the people that write about the coming economic collapse love to talk about the coming collapse of the US dollar as well. But in the initial deflationary stage of the coming financial crisis, we are likely to see the US dollar actually strengthen considerably. As I've discussed so many times before, we are going to experience deflation first, and after that deflationary phase, the desperate responses by the Federal Reserve and the US government to that deflation will cause the inflationary panic that so many have written about. Yes, someday the US dollar will eventually be toilet paper, but that is not our immediate future. What is in our immediate future is a flight to safety that will push the surging US dollar even higher. This is what we witnessed in 2008, and this is happening once again right now. And I should point out that in earlier articles on this blog, it's been posted that the collapse in oil price is something that also occurred in 2008, that there's a number of indicators that are combining again that are identical to what happened in 2008. Just looking at the chart I have posted, reading from the article again, you can see the US dollar moved upward dramatically relative to other currencies starting in mid-2008. And toward the end of that chart, you can see that the US dollar is now experiencing a similar spike. At the moment, almost every major currency in the world is falling relative to the US dollar. Instead of focusing on the US dollar, those that are looking for a harbinger of the coming financial crisis should be watching the euro. Analysts that are telling us that if Greece leaves the eurozone, the euro could fall all the way down to 0.90. Unfortunately, most Americans have no idea how important all of this is. In recent years, growing economies all over the world have borrowed gigantic piles of very cheap US dollars. But now they are faced with the prospect of repaying those debts and making interest payments much more expensive in much more expensive US dollars. Investors are starting to get nervous. At one time, investors couldn't wait to pour money into emerging markets. But now this process is beginning to reverse. If this turns into a panic, we are going to have one giant financial mess on our hands. The truth is that the value of the US dollar is of great importance to every nation on the face of the earth. Now, while the US dollar is skyrocketing, most of the other countries in the industrialized world are going through a money printing spree. And we've seen it in Australia. We've seen interest rates lowered several times over the past couple of years in Australia, and it's now on the cards that they're going to drop again this year. We're seeing in Europe the quite bizarre situation now where you actually have negative interest rates. And again, this is such a counterintuitive thing, and it goes so against the basic principle of how the fractional reserve monetary system is meant to work, that I think it's not really getting enough attention, because I think people don't understand it. I mean, I don't understand it. And there's a lot of things about the economy that are just mind-bogglingly difficult to grasp. But what we do know for certain is that there are interests who are constantly manipulating the system for the benefit of a tiny oligarchy. I want to read to you a Q&A from The Guardian about negative interest rates. This may help to fill in some of our ignorance about that particular subject. The European Central Bank, ECB, has cut the interest rates banks receive when they deposit money with the ECB. The ECB has cut its headline interest rate to a record low of 0.15% and also imposed negative interest rates of minus 0.1% on Eurozone banks to encourage them to lend to small firms rather than to hoard cash. How do negative interest rates work? Instead of earning interest rates on money left with the ECB, banks are charged by the central bank to park their cash with it. The ECB cut its deposit rate to minus 0.1% on Thursday, and the hope is that this will encourage banks to stop hoarding money and instead lend more to each other, to consumers and to businesses, in turn boosting the broader economy. Now, this is, of course, in response to what appears to be a critical deflationary spiral that has taken over in Europe. There is a shortage of money. And so dropping interest rates is one way of dealing with that traditionally. But when interest rates are already at zero, the only thing you can do is reverse the whole thing. But that is just so counterintuitive. It is so against the way the whole system is meant to work that one has to see it as a flashing red warning sign of something very, very serious approaching. We are going to break. I'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm talking a little about the economy today. I'm talking about deflation. I'm talking about negative interest rates in Europe and trying to understand what is actually going on. I'm going to play to you a little animation with audio that I found from The Telegraph that explains a little bit about deflation, because deflation is the key thing to understand when you're trying to figure out why are they dropping interest rates below zero. They're trying to pump money into the economy. So let's just play the clip here on deflation, and then we'll continue.
Deflation is when the prices of goods and services starts falling. This sounds like good news for consumers, but for economists, long periods of negative price growth are worrying. Most of the world's central banks have an inflation target of 2%. This is the Goldilocks level. They think is just about right to ensure prices remain stable. Anything too high or too low is a cause of concern. To work out whether we should be cheering or fearing low prices, it's important to divide good types of deflation from bad. When the things like food and oil fall in price, it can be a positive for consumers. Paying less to feed ourselves, heat our homes, and fill up our cars means we have more to spend on other things. In Britain, factors like supermarket price wars and collapsing oil prices can help to act like a big tax cut to us all. Other forms of benign deflation come from higher levels of productivity and technological progress. For example, the cost of basic computing power has fallen dramatically in the last 40 years. But if better supply represents good deflation, lower demand makes it dangerous. Struggling companies who start slashing prices and laying off workers just to remain in profit is bad for the economy. Sustained deflation also means the value of our money is increasing. We get more for our pound, so more of us may decide to delay purchasing that television we think will cost less in a month's time. And for those of us in debt, well, the cost of our repayments gets higher. If bad deflation grips an economic area and becomes entrenched, it could affect other economies, which is why we should all care about deflation.
Well, there is a quick intro to deflation. Didn't really tell me anything I didn't already know. The key thing to understand there is that deflation represents a shrinking money supply in the market. And when you think like a banker, you think about the money supply en masse, and you think about it either growing or shrinking, and you try to manipulate it, if you're a central banker, to be at a level which is sort of balancing the various extremes against each other. When we see a deflationary trend, that there is actually a reduction of money available, and that can actually become kind of like a snowball effect. And so, again, returning to the question of negative interest rates, as it said there in the Guardian report, the purpose of negative interest rates is to encourage banks to stop hoarding money, to encourage them to lend more money. This will put more money into the economy. Now, one of the effects of this quantitative easing, this money printing that's been taking place in Europe, is that the US dollar has taken off. But of course, the US interest rates have already been very close to zero, effectively at zero for several years, which had driven the US dollar down. But now what's happened is that other countries have simply adopted the same strategy as the US, which has then made the US dollar relatively high. But the overall situation is that we seem to be moving deeper and deeper into this deflationary situation in our economy. Now here, continuing from the article in The Guardian, it says, will it work? No one knows. In theory, it sounds attractive, but it has never been attempted by the Eurozone and could have unpredictable and unintended consequences. Those consequences include the possibility that banks will pass on to customers the costs they incur for depositing money with the ECB. A broad risk is that a negative return on parking funds with the central bank might encourage banks to invest in riskier assets to secure a return, potentially driving new asset bubbles and more pain further down the line. As part of this bid to find alternative investments, banks are likely to increase their purchases of government bonds. However, this has potentially serious consequences if banks are holding bonds to such an extent that government borrowing costs are artificially low. If a financial shock occurs, the banks and governments could find themselves so intertwined and interdependent that they drag each other and the economy down. So I leave that with you. I do not claim to know. I'm certainly not a pundit in these matters. I simply have a very strong gut feeling that something is wrong, something's rotten in the state of Denmark. And in fact, Denmark is a very interesting country to raise in this case, because Denmark is one of the countries that has embarked on negative interest rates, as has Sweden. But when something seems amiss, when things seem totally counterintuitive, and most of the spin is that, oh, look, it's fine, everything's normal, that's something to be concerned about. I mean, we saw that in 2008 as the GFC approached. Everyone was pretending that this was just normal, that all these very extreme scenarios that were unfolding were just fluctuations, and it was all going to balance itself out. And it wasn't until we were, like, deep into it, until effectively the Wall Street bankers were confronting the government and saying, look, there's going to be martial law unless you intervene, because the stock market's going to plunge to zero. I mean, this kind of just happened overnight. Suddenly there were these meetings where the bankers were saying, look, you know, the country is going to be in a state of complete chaos and collapse unless you intervene right now and give us billions of dollars, or trillions of dollars. I think it was a $800 billion bailout that was required immediately. That was when George Bush was still the president. So when it comes, folks, expect it to come suddenly with virtually no warning, and then you'll find out that, well, actually, we did know all along it was coming, we just didn't tell you. That's kind of the way it will pan out. I want to return now to the WikiLeaks topic, and I've got a clip here from a press conference that was held summarising some of the recent developments in the WikiLeaks case. The man speaking is, his native language is Spanish, Judge Baltazar Garzon, and he is the chief legal representative of Julian Assange, and there is a translator translating most of what he said, and then there'll be some other speakers coming on after that. I may skip through some of the parts because I think there's a little bit of a problem with some of the audio in it. But I'll start that now. We'll be going to break shortly, but I'll continue after the break with this very important press conference from WikiLeaks. Here we go.
Again, at the Swiss Press Club, I'm here on this occasion to speak about WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and other people who are affected by the proceedings currently going on in Sweden and in the United States.
En la actualidad y desde hace cuatro años, al menos cuatro años, se sigue un proceso judicial secreto en Estados Unidos contra WikiLeaks, sus fundadores, especialmente Julian Assange, y otros miembros de esta plataforma de información y comunicación.
For the past 4 years, a secret warrant has been going on in the United States with an inquiry against WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and other people involved in the process.
Todos saben cuál es el, y todas saben cuál es el origen de esta investigación, que no fue otro que la publicación de masiva de documentos, en muchos de los casos sensibles, en todo caso, que afectaba a Estados Unidos.
You will know that the origin for this inquiry is, of course, the mass publication of documents that implicated the United States via the leaks.
Desde entonces, la suerte de Julian Assange, de alguna forma, estaba echada, y era cuestión de que, de una forma o de otra, iba a ser sometido a procedimiento penal.
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Stay with us. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm playing to you a press conference that was conducted in Europe regarding WikiLeaks and regarding some of the important information that has recently come forward. And we're playing to you an audio here that includes speeches from WikiLeaks Chief Legal Representative Judge Baltazar Garzón. So I'll just continue here now with the audio.
Therefore, Julian Assange's cards were played in advance. It was more of a matter of how this would happen, but one way or another, it was clear that it would be stopped.
Es lo que ocurrió con Julian Assange y los hechos que hoy día se le imputan en Suecia, pero de los que, curiosamente, después de cuatro años, no hay ni un solo cargo contra el mismo.
And this is what's going... Pardon. These are the facts in regards to the charges that are being brought forward, including in Sweden, where, weirdly enough, after 4 years, absolutely nothing has amounted of the charges.
Julian Assange estuvo a disposición cinco semanas desde que conoció que se le relacionaba con algunos hechos en Suecia, salió fuera del país con autorización de la Fiscalía, estuvo a disposición en Alemania, estuvo a disposición en Gran Bretaña y solo posteriormente y de forma absolutamente sorpresiva fue sometido a procedimiento mediante una orden de detención internacional.
That's Judge Baltazar Garzón speaking, and in what follows I have edited out the Spanish language and you're only going to hear the translation into English.
Julian Assange has...
Julian Assange has been available for questioning. He has been available for questioning immediately after he was made aware of the charges against him in Sweden.
He exited the country with a legal authorization. He was available again for questioning in Germany and again later again available for questioning in Great Britain. It was only via an extraordinary proceeding that an international arrest warrant was issued.
Quiero decir con esto que siempre ha estado a disposición de las autoridades suecas para aclarar, para declarar y para exponer todo lo que fue requerido para ello, sin que hasta este momento se haya posibilitado esa circunstancia.
What I'm trying to clarify here is that he has been available for questioning by the Swedish government, whether to clarify, to explicit, to respond to any questions, and for some reason the Swedish government hasn't taken this opportunity. Julian Assange, his lawyer, his legal team, everyone around in the process, there have been a number of petitions asking that the Swedish government, why the Swedish government didn't want to question Julian Assange for these proceedings. And these questions have not been answered. What we do know is that in 100% of these types of international proceedings, the person is indeed questioned. And this, although despite being available, has not happened. Since August 16, 2012, Julian Assange has been granted asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, and neither the British government nor the Swedish government have recognized this official legal status and have allowed him the impunity that would allow him to travel to Ecuador, where he would be facing the same charges from there. What we're looking at, this has become a case that is actually impossible to imagine that it even exists in the 21st century. Julian Assange's rights have not been respected, whether as an asylum seeker or whether of someone under an international mandate, whether his right to be heard on the case he's being accused of, and again, his right to be able to leave the embassy into Ecuador. All of his rights are being violated. We welcome the bravery of Ecuador, who has gone forward with the asylum proceedings. His legal team have been asking for him to move forward and to be in his being wanted for testimony, and we have not been able to. So the proceedings are not being permitted, and this is why we're moving forward with the case and here today. I don't know.
So we have secret proceedings going on in the United States, in the District of Virginia. There is a paralyzed process in Sweden that has been actually paralyzed for 4 years. And this morning, we assisted in the UN at the Swedish UPR, where Swedish was being heard in terms of their human rights standard. And we hope that that would be a place where finally this case could be heard and finally move forward. About a month ago, we found out that the U.S. government was under another investigation through the order of a federal judge, Anderson, and we found out that the U.S. government had asked Google to hand in all information related to email, metadata, and other documents by WikiLeaks staff personnel and other associated people whose Fourth Amendment right was violated without any cause or justification. We thank the country who have extended their diplomatic courtesy today and have supported the case, the access to proof from Sweden on the case of Julian Assange. Any person in detention, anyone in any type of detention, deserves the cooperation and deserves to have the full information about the investigation they are under. As an asylum seeker, Julian Assange also has that right, and so we hope that the process today, with the support of the member state, will move on to an efficient process that will finally lead to the discovery of documents. As a jurist, in order to conclude this intervention, as a jurist, I have to say that I am terribly shocked by the behavior of Sweden, the United States, and Great Britain, who over 2.5 years have not found a way to move forward towards a solution. This case has been supported by many petitions and a great interest also, obviously, by the Ecuadorian government, who have been trying to facilitate the proceedings. And the cost of this paralysis is currently an indispensable right, and that is the right of asylum that has been granted to Julian Assange and is not yet implemented as such. Today, during the proceedings, Sweden, in response during its UPR review, at no point did they answer any of the interrogations and the questions that were raised in regards to the case and the situation. No mention of any of the proceedings were made by Sweden on the occasion of the UPR.
Okay, so the next person that will be speaking is actually one of WikiLeaks' lawyers in the United States, Michael Ratner from CCR. You got him one?
Okay. Thank you, Balthazar Garzon. Balthazar has played a critical role in leading our legal team, and thank you, Sarah and Kristen, for being there in Geneva. I'm Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. We represent WikiLeaks and Julian Assange in the United States. We also represent Sarah Harrison, Joseph Farrell, and Kristen Hermafison, three journalists and editors with WikiLeaks, were the recipients of the notification from Google about the fact that their emails had been searched and seized. I want to bring you up to date a bit on what's happened in the United States with regard to that. On December 23rd, just over 6 weeks ago, these three WikiLeaks journalists were notified by Google that pursuant to search and seizure warrants, it, Google, had provided the United States law enforcement officials with all of the email content, drafts of email, deleted emails, subscriber data, metadata, contacts, addresses, photographs, essentially everything associated with the accounts of these three journalists. Everything, personal, and even to the extent there was email on there, attorney-client communications. The warrants acted like a huge vacuum cleaner. It's shocking that the United States would do that to a journalist organization and to journalists working in that organization. In addition, there were a number of shocking revelations in these warrants, in addition to the, quote, give us everything you have, Google. First of all, although issued on March 22, 2012, Google waited over 2.5 years, that's 2.5 years, to notify its subscribers of these warrants.
Okay, we're just going to break you with Truth News Radio, and I'm playing you here some clips from a press conference that was held in Geneva in Switzerland about WikiLeaks, and summarising some of the developments and some of the really shocking developments that have occurred. So stay with us. We'll continue with that after the break.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? And at that point,
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And it is a great pleasure and a great honour to be able to bring you this show, as I do every week. And let me just take this opportunity to encourage you to become a subscriber. I really do need the financial support of subscribers. This show is under a lot of financial pressure. And unfortunately, I'm now in a position where some of my other income streams have actually dropped off. And I'm actually going to be probably working full-time, and this show is going to suffer as a result of it. But I will continue doing the show, I'll continue doing the interviews, but it's going to be more and more difficult. If we could get the number of subscribers up to 500, that would be a kind of a threshold by which I think that the show could continue, and I would have enough bandwidth, enough financial support to be able to do what I need without doing a whole lot of other things that I don't really want to be doing. It's a sad situation to say that we have this problem in our society where all of the wealth and the economic activity is given towards certain things, when there are things that need to be done, there are important services that need to be provided, and it seems virtually impossible to find ways to get the funding or the support for that. And I think part of that is the problem with the general public. Even people who are very aware of conspiracies and very aware of a lot of the problems in our society, they don't really see it as being important, because they think, look, there's a ton of alternative bloggers out there, and they just all do it out of the goodness of their hearts, and we don't have to worry because, you know, they're just all doing it for free, and I'll just pick and choose from the smorgasbord of alternative news that I feel like grabbing today, and gee, you know, I don't really want to be paying for all of that. But you know, here's the problem. In Australia, there really isn't much to pick and choose from. There is a lot more in other countries. But even there, what you see is it's really hard to find quality stuff. A lot of the people who are willing to put the time into doing presentations, doing YouTubes, don't sort of have the critical expertise, don't have the technological knowledge, and aren't able to get something up to a level that meets a certain standard. I try to meet a standard with what I do. I know I often fail. And one of the problems is without financial support for what you do, it's even harder to reach that standard. And I've had some people complain to me about the quality of my shows. And they've said, you know, you haven't had good guests on. And you know what? You're right. And it actually takes a hell of a lot of effort to get good guests on. It takes more time and more organization. Last year, I actually had someone helping me with that. And she unfortunately can't help me anymore due to other financial pressures, and I'm forced to do everything on my own, and again that makes it harder, and again that impacts on quality. And then I get people saying, well, gee, your quality's dropped off, I don't think I want to pay. This is the kind of vicious circle that we find ourselves in when we try to do this kind of stuff. So if you're a subscriber, if there's someone out there that you think might like this show, let them know about it. If you've been listening to the show for a while and you're not a subscriber, just think about what I've said. It's very easy to go over to the website and join up, and you get your free T-shirt, and we get to continue. Anyway, returning now to the press conference with WikiLeaks, a very, very important subject here that's being raised. This is about the seizure of emails from WikiLeaks staffers. Going back to the beginning of time, Google basically seized everything and handed it over to the government. I mean, this is an incredibly serious development, folks, and an incredibly important warning sign to not use Gmail. I mean, just listen to me right now. Listen to my words. Do not use Gmail. If you have a Gmail account, stop using it right now. Okay? It's that simple. Google will just hand over your information. I mean, okay, I know we're already aware of Prism. We're already aware of the Snowden revelations. We know the NSA is doing sort of trawling, massive data acquisition. This is different. This is targeted data acquisition where the government said, we want all the emails for Sarah Harrison, one of the WikiLeaks journalists. And Google said, okay, here you go. Now, that's a lot easier than what the NSA does, where they have to kind of use all their technology and filter and use artificial intelligence to try and find what's important, what's not. This is basically Google just saying, here you go, here's all Sarah Harrison's content and nicely catalogued, you know, all the information you need, including metadata, right? So time to stop using Gmail, folks. Anyway, continuing now with the press conference here that was held at the Geneva Press Conference in January 2015. And we're listening at the moment to Michael Ratner speaking from the US.
This is the subscribers could take no action to stop them. It's to be reflected and looked at Twitter, what Twitter did in a similar situation. They went to court, they litigated it, and were able to notify the subscribers that the US wanted the accounts of. We don't know if Google tried to litigate it or not, but that's one of our requests to Google, 2.5 years. A second striking thing in the warrants is that they were issued to working journalists. All of the material in the United States, all of the press reports, et cetera, fail really to recognize what has happened to Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, and other journalists working with them. There's been an incredible long-term, and as Balthazar said, 4-year attack against these journalists. A third important aspect of these search and seizure warrants is that they were done on the basis that the United States asserted that the emails and other material from these journalists contained evidence of violations of the Espionage Act, conspiracy to commit espionage, violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and other federal laws. In other words, somehow, the U.S. was putting together a conspiracy charge for espionage and perhaps more against WikiLeaks and the journalists associated with it. In addition, the journalists and WikiLeaks and myself and none of the lawyers have any idea of what was taken, what was the content of what was taken. In the end, every working journalist should be appalled by these warrants. Unfortunately, this is another demonstration of what we have been saying for a number of years. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are targets of a massive U.S. criminal investigation of their journalistic activities, going back, as Balthazar said, at least 4 years. It's unlike WikiLeaks, of course, to sit back and just simply say, go on. Yes, they're continuing to do their work, but they're also fighting back. In response to these revelations, WikiLeaks sent 3 lawyers' letters today. The first is to Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Google. In those letters, we make a number of requests of Google and Eric Schmidt. First, we want to know why were our clients, Sarah Harrison, Joseph Farrell, and Kristen Hrafnson, not notified until 2.5 years later of the warrants. Google claims there was a gag order, an order prohibiting them from telling our clients of these incredible broad warrants for their material. But the question is, did Google litigate that gag order so it could tell its subscribers, or did it simply let the government suck up all of its subscriber information? We need to know that. And what's interesting about that is that a year before those warrants were issued, or almost a year before, Julian Assange had a conversation with Eric Schmidt, the head of Google. And in that conversation, Julian asked Schmidt to notify WikiLeaks if a warrant like this was received, and pointed to Twitter as an example of what should be done. As far as we know, that was not done. And our clients were not notified, and for all we know, no action was taken by Google to stop these warrants. We also have asked Google for a list of all the materials disclosed to the federal government. And finally, we asked, did Google get other search warrants for other Google subscribers that were affiliated with WikiLeaks? We want those answers from Eric Schmidt, and we want them soon. The other two letters are to prosecution authorities in the United States. One is to the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, and the other is to the Chief Prosecutor of the Eastern District of Virginia, the federal court that has been involved in the investigation and the prosecutor that has been involved in the investigation of WikiLeaks. These letters ask a most important question, and our clients are entitled to answers. First, is there an ongoing criminal investigation of our clients? What is the status of that investigation? And are our clients witnesses to that investigation, subjects of that investigation, or targets of those investigations? They have a right to know. 4 years is long enough for a sword of Damocles to be held over their head. And 4 years is long enough for Julian Assange to have been under allegations. And 2 years is long enough for him to have been confined in that embassy. The additional thing we ask is for an inventory of all materials that the federal government took from Google. They ask for everything on those Google subscriber lists. What about materials that were protected by the attorney-client privilege? What do they do about those?
We'll just have to leave it there. We're at the end of the hour. This is really a very important story, folks, and I hope that you see the gravity of it. I mean, Google is so pervasive in our society. Google is kind of like the air we breathe. People take it for granted that we use Google for just about everything we do. People have Google accounts. Google tracks everything you do. And the fact that they so casually hand over information to the government without even notifying the people concerned, years later, they found out. Well, that's an indication of where we're at, folks. It's a very, very serious situation. I don't know what else to say. It's sort of mind-boggling. We are going to break. When I come back from break, Stephanie Messenger will be joining us, and we'll be talking again about the saga of Cherie Tenpenny and the cancelled vaccine lecture tour. A really interesting 1 hour discussion coming up in hour 2. Stay with us.